Good morning and welcome to A Penny for Your Thoughts with Brian Barnhart on News Talk 1400 WDWS. For over 60 years, East Central Illinois' daily gathering spot for conversation, dialogue, and ideas. You can join in on the phone, online, or via a text. Our phone number is 217-356-9397. Email talk at WDWS.com. Or text us on the Castle Heating and Cooling text line, 217-351-5357. Now, here's Brian Barnhart.
And good morning, everybody. Welcome, Penny for Your Thoughts, News Talk 1400 DWS on this Wednesday, the 16th day of May. Currently 63 degrees in downtown Champaign. Sunshine trying to break through. Partly sunny day in store for us, as you heard from Michael on the weather. And we've got another busy show for you today. In the second hour, Jim Dye of the News Gazette will be joining us. We'll talk about all the big issues of the day, everything from China urging its ally North Korea to proceed with that historic summit. North Koreans threatening to say, hey, we're not going to meet. They're at least threatening that. We'll see what happens. Also, some news locally involving a police member of the police department. So we'll talk about that a little bit of a strange story there. Our news department has been covering that particular story today. And also we'll visit in the first hour with Travis McDade. He is an author. He's a curator of law rare books at the University of Illinois. He has written a new book that is just out. It's called Torn from Their Bindings, a story of art, science, and the pillaging of American university libraries. And we'll talk about a young man at the time, Robert Kindred. We'll identify him and talk about his past. He was from Villa Grove. He eventually wound up on a spree across the country, eventually wound up back here in Champaign-Urbana at the University of Illinois. And the story kind of goes from there, how the U of I Police Department became involved. There's some names you'll recognize in law enforcement and judges that were involved in the case. All this back to 1980. So we'll talk about the author of the book, Torn from Their Bindings, Travis McDade, from over at the University of Illinois, here in our number one. That story on the police officer I was telling you about, the Champaign police officer due back in court in July on charges he took items from several vehicles in his home community of Fisher. That's 43-year-old Justice Clinton. We'll talk about that a little bit in the second hour with Jim Dye. All right, we'll take our opening timeout. Again, the phone numbers today, 356-9397. You can call us. You can text us, Castle Heating and Cooling text line 351-5357. And you can email us at talk@wdws.com. We'll come back and bring in our guests, get it started here for the first hour, Jim Dye in hour number two, on a busy Penny for Your Thoughts here in the middle of May. We're back in a moment. Want to remind you that this is the final week for you to show your support for your favorite businesses in the News Talk 1400 People's Choice Competition. Take a couple of minutes and vote at WDWS.com. Vote in one category or all 150 if you like. The People's Choice from News Gazette Media and Wallace Land and Auction. We're here on Penny for Your Thoughts. We'll have Jim Dye join us in hour number two. Pleased to be joined, though, in this first hour by Travis McDade. He is over at the University of Illinois, curator of law, rare books, and associate professor of library science. Travis McDade, and an author. This is the fourth time, right?
It's hard to believe. Yeah. I saw on the internet when I was looking up this book the other day, it has my picture and then four books underneath it, and it's difficult to believe. But yeah, this is the fourth one.
Well, tell about yourself real quick. How long you been at the U of I, and what exactly do you do?
So I got here in 2004 permanently. Before that, I was a graduate student for a year in 2001 and 2002. And I work at the law library. I do law reference, and I teach legal research, and then I'm curator of rare books. So when people need to do research on any of the old books that we have there, I'm there to assist them and give them access to that and help them find things, that sort of thing.
You've probably been asked this several times, but define a rare book. When you say a rare book, is that what does that mean? I mean, just old,
or is it more sometimes than that? Means old. It's more than that. As a sort of shorthand, clumsy way to do it, just to know what to include in the collection of old books. We usually start at about 1800, and anything older than 1800 we would put in the rare book, or at the law school, at least put in the rare book collection at the law school. So not everything before 1800 is, of course, rare, but and not everything after 1800 is not rare. But but that's a good sort of shorthand way of identifying it. And then depending on how many of these things still exist. For instance, my second book is about the theft of a Poe, Edgar Allan Poe book of poetry that was published in 1829. So, you know, of course, after 1800. But it's it's extremely rare because there are only a few of them left, and it's Edgar Allan Poe. So that's what makes it in demand, I guess.
Does the U of I library and the law school have a lot of those kind of books?
Oh, yeah.
Old books?
Yeah, yeah. We have we're lucky here in East Central Illinois to have the U of I for many reasons. But maybe chief among them is our library, which, of course, is enormous, and the rare book collection, almost all of which is housed at the Rare Book and Manuscript Library on campus, or on the main campus, rather, not at the law school where I work. And that collection there is quite simply amazing. And if your listeners don't know about it and haven't visited, I would recommend getting to know it if you are a fan of old things. They really, really have a stunning collection there. I know that people who work for the University of Illinois trot out superlatives to say how great the U of I is in many respects. But when it comes to the rare book collection, we really are one of the top few in the country.
In the country.
Yeah.
The latest book you've written, the fourth book, is called Torn from Their Bindings, Story of Art, Science, and the Pillaging of American University Libraries. So since you work in this field, I know it kind of personally when you told this story that we're about to tell here. I mean, that's kind of a personal thing,
right?
It is
personal, yeah. It's funny because, especially with this book, more than the other ones, this was the most personal, because a lot of it happened here on campus, but B, because in the course of my research, I would find these books that had been cut, right, that had had these illustrations cut from them, and, you know, you would open the book, or I'd open the book, and I would see a page that had been torn out or had been razored out, and it just felt... I mean, there was some almost visceral feeling about it to see this destruction of a book. It bothered me quite a bit, and so it did feel almost like a personal harm.
All right, let's tell the story here. Let's start. We can start big picture with Robert Kindred. Who is he? And he was from Villa Grove, right?
Yeah, Bobby Kindred from Villa Grove. Grew up down there in relatively poor circumstances. His father died when he was young, and he had a big family. But a loving family and a mom who cared a great deal and sisters who cared a great deal about him. And he was a hardworking guy, a hardworking kid. He worked when he was in high school at the Dog and Suds and a couple other places just off campus. And then he joined the Air Force. He was in the Air Force for a couple years. And then he...
Did he go through Chanute then, or was involved there or not?
I don't think he went through Chanute.
Okay.
I think he started in Florida. I think Florida is where he did his basic training and was in, I think he was somewhere in the Northeast. It was either Maine or Newfoundland or something, in Canada.
Way out
something
there.
Up there. Yeah. And he was only in for a few years. He didn't care for it, but he was quite a salesman and he got out and he became a salesman and then eventually moved out to California, in the 60s and, just sort of completely by accident got involved in what's called the antique print business. Now, antique prints are lithographs, etchings, engravings, any sort of printed item that often hand-colored that were produced largely in the 19th century. Some of them were before the 19th century, of course. And many of them, of course, were in books, in science books, biology books, ornithological books, in an effort to help explain the scientific process or to show people what these birds look like in the wild, and they were really terrific. Some of the best artists of the age actually wrote
in the 1800s.
Did work for these journals. In order to get these things, of course, he would either have to buy these journals, which were rare and difficult to come by, even when you could, and then were expensive if you could. Or he would just, of course, go to a library where they were housed and get to them that way. Mm. And then he would sell them either loose or he would frame them. That was his business.
Yeah, there were several people doing this. This is the late 70s.
Yeah, that's right.
Was he one of several people doing this kind of thing, going to public libraries, university libraries, and just stealing this
stuff? I think at the beginning. So one of the interesting things about rare book theft is it's been around for a good long while, and these things have often been vulnerable. Books as well as, in this case, pieces of books. So plenty of people were doing this work. He was sort of a pioneer in doing it wholesale, mm-hmm. and doing it in the service of his own profession, which was as an antique print dealer. Mm-hmm. But plenty of people, of course, have been stealing these things for a good long while.
So he would just do it. He would go to the library, find out where these things, rare books, were,
yep.
and then just cut whatever out he wanted, and then try to sell it.
He started out by happenstance. He found a book. He decided to frame up some of the things that were in this book, put them on his own wall, and then he just sold some of these on the side, and people were interested in them, and it sort of snowballed into a career. And so it wasn't that he just started stealing from libraries. He also got books legitimately. If he could buy them, he would buy them. And in many of the cases of these illustrated books, they were battered and beaten, and people were using them as doorstops. And so he could get them for free. But it was only after he had made a career out of this that he found that these things were hard to find on demand. He was part of a rent paying outfit, and then he started getting competition. Other people started doing this, and so that's kind of when he started turning to libraries.
So he gets these items eventually as he leads up to it. Who's buying them? I mean,
That's interesting. So you would think that the market for this would be like he would have a store and people would come in who wanted to buy one or two of these things for their their house, and
thinking it's a rare art.
Thinking
form.
That's right.
It's the original or whatever.
That's right. And they were worth that amount of money. That's the sort of thing you could do. And in fact, if you go to certain cities, Chicago amongst them, they have places where you can buy framed copies of these things for several hundred dollars. But he got in the home furnishing business in Southern California. They were building houses, one after another, mm-hmm. boom, 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 in the late 1970s, as you can imagine. And he got in with these guys who needed to outfit these houses, and so he needed to buy these things in quantity. He needed to have these things in quantity, as opposed to selling them one at a time retail. He needed to sell these things wholesale, and so because of that, that's why he needed to have a constant supply.
Mm-hmm. For a kid who grew up in Villa Grove, didn't have a lot,
right?
He was doing pretty well.
He was doing
then.
Pretty well. I think he was a pig in clover at the beginning, and I always come at these guys. I started at a negative point with these guys. I always know them from their lowest, from their lowest moment in life. I know them from their crime. And with him, I've spent 10 years working on this, and I've tried to see his side of it as much as possible.
And you've talked to him, right?
I have talked to him. Yeah. And, he was just a regular guy, like a lot of regular guys. And he started out with good intentions. He was working hard. He found this place. He got sort of underwater and made some bad decisions. And I think once those were made, once he decided it was okay to take these things from libraries, and many people think it's okay to take things from libraries, I don't think he ever grappled with it much again.
So eventually, talking about libraries, they didn't really have high security.
Nope.
I mean, so you could scout these things out.
Yep.
This is late 70s. There's no internet. You just go in there and kind of pick off what you need, and nobody really paid much attention. Probably.
Yeah, it's absolutely true, including right here at U of I. Many of the most important and valuable of these bird prints, and a variety of flora and fauna, we're just sitting on the shelves of these major research libraries. Mm-hmm. Of course, most public libraries didn't have these sorts of books, but institutions like the U of I, like IU, like
all the major
research institutions that he hits on this little trip. Yeah, mm-hmm. They all had these.
Yeah, we're with Travis McDade. His new book is just out, Torn from Their Bindings. It is out now, right? Is it, or are we close?
I think it's
down?
Out in a week.
Okay.
Yeah, you can pre-order it now.
Okay.
On Amazon, but I don't think it'll be shipped for like a week or so.
All right. Well, I've got an advanced copy here.
Yeah.
So Torn from Their Bindings is the name of it. He's over at the University of Illinois before we take a break, he eventually wound up going cross country.
Yeah.
What, Texas A&M, Rice.
Yep. Loyola, all the way across the South up to D.C. and then back through the Midwest. Yeah.
And eventually wound up in Urbana.
Yeah.
Late June of 1980.
Yep.
And we're going to take a break and we'll come back and pick up the story there because yep. U of I law enforcement gets involved.
Yep.
Several names in the legal profession that we know that are still around
yep.
are involved, and we'll take it from there. If you have any questions, if you remember any of this, there was a lot of other things going on at the time in the late 70s. The Dave Wilson case comes into play.
Yeah, it does.
We'll talk about that. All of this straight ahead with Travis McDade. If you have any questions or comments or memories or thoughts, feel free to give us a call, 356-9397. Text us on the Castle Heating and Cooling text line, 351-5357, or email us talk at WDWS.com. Back with Travis McDade in a moment. Travis McDade is our guest from over at the University of Illinois. We're talking about his new book, which is out, his fourth book, Torn from Their Bindings. He works over at the University of Illinois, curator of law rare books over at the U of I, associate professor of library science. And he is, it says here, the country's foremost expert on crimes against rare books, maps, documents, and other printed cultural heritage resources. We're talking about a story about Robert Kindred, who was from Villa Grove, got involved in stealing eventually. A lot of this rare artwork and other things. Eventually works his way across the country, winds up coming back to Urbana, where he's got some family. He actually, late June, stayed at the Howard Johnson.
Yeah, that's right.
On North 45.
Still out there. Yeah. I mean, it's not a, it's not a Howard Johnson anymore, but the building's still there. Yeah.
Yeah. And but it was right across from Frasca Field.
Yep.
And eventually, take us to the night, late June, he's trying to steal some items from the U of I library, right?
Yeah, so the U of I library back then had closed stacks. And one of the things that they had done during the summer was go to all these institutions that had open stacks. And they would go during the day, and one of these guys would keep lookout, and the other guy would just sit there and cut the bird prints out of the books. And so he came back here, and his mom was in a local nursing home, and he was going to spend the weekend visiting family and seeing his mom and his sister lived in Urbana. He was gonna see her, and so they decided that one of the things of just going in and cutting things out at the U of I, like they had at these other places, they would steal whole books. And so they had to sort of figure out how to do that, and the way they figured out how to do that was to sort of crawl on, for people who know the U of I library, and I'm certain many of your listeners have been on Gregory Drive there on the south side of the main library. You can see the stacks back there, and the sort of south edifice of the stacks there has a bunch of windows in it. And what they ultimately decided to do was to break in, and then there's two of these guys together. So Robert Kindred, Green was his confederate. Mm-hmm. And so Kindred would break in, climb in a window, go up to the stacks, find the books that he, and then he would lower them down the side of the building with this black nylon rope they had bought at the Champagne Surplus. And then Green would take this packet of books and then, you know, put it somewhere, and then they would do that a few times, and then they would be done for the night. Mm-hmm. And I described these books as you know, $7,000-$8,000 worth of books in each packet each time they're doing this,
yeah.
And cut apart and framed, these things would be worth even more. And so they did this on Saturday night, and then they meant to do it again on Sunday night and did the same sort of routine. It was around midnight.
And they had a big Cadillac they were storing all this stuff in.
1979 Cadillac, yeah. Fleetwood Brougham. I've got a picture of it in the
yeah. What they parked it when they were doing it, they parked it back somewhere close by, 6th in the Green or somewhere.
Green dropped Kindred off, so Kindred would sort of scramble up and break in, mm-hmm. and then he went and parked it somewhere, maybe over on Goodwin or something, mm-hmm. far enough away that people couldn't identify it,
yeah.
but close enough that they could get it when they were done. Mm-hmm. And then Green would come back. And the idea was to take these things, stow them somewhere, and then get the car and come back. And so they'd driven this enormous car across country, and it had this large trunk. Of course, your listeners will remember the size of the trunks of these things.
Yeah, with all kinds of stuff in them from all they had stolen.
With all kinds of stuff, that's right. Yeah. So there are thousands and thousands of these prints already in the back of this Cadillac. So Kendra breaks in and goes up there, and this is the second night they're doing this, and he had lowered one of these packets of books down. Now, I say a packet of books. I have a picture of this in my book. Mm-hmm. These are not the sort of books that you would ordinarily think of when I say a book. These are the size of a tabletop. I mean, these are enormous, enormous, and very heavy books. And he's got four of these, and it's close to 150 pounds, this thing, that he's lowering down the side of the main library. And he's got one of these done, and he's in the process of lowering the second one of the night down. And this maintenance man shows up, this guy whose job it is to check the air conditioning. Mm-hmm. Now, this guy doesn't show up because there's anything wrong with the air conditioning at the library. It's just that every five nights he drives to the library around midnight and mm-hmm. checks on, you know, goes down there and checks all the gauges and mm-hmm. and makes sure everything's in the green. And this was that night, and he just happened to show up it just happened to be at the time when they're right in the middle of this crime.
So eventually, the U of I police get wind of this.
Yeah.
Something's going on.
Yeah. So this.
And they eventually start to stake out because they know he had to leave something behind. And then they have to come back and try to. They're going to try to catch him in the act, right?
Yeah. So it's funny because it's the sort of thing where no one really knows what's going on. So the maintenance man or the steam operator doesn't know. That there's anything going on. He just stumbles over this pile of books. He doesn't, you know, he didn't see anyone.
Right.
And he stumbles over this pile of books. He calls the university police dispatcher and says, you know, there's this pile of books out there. And the university dispatcher is like, okay, there's a pile of books near the library, you know, we'll send a SWAT team or something,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And so they send an officer out there and the air conditioning guy goes into the heating and air conditioning building. And then when he comes out to meet the officer, those books are gone. And that sort of sets off this mystery, like what happened to these books that were there 5 minutes ago or 10 minutes ago? And so the officer walks around and doesn't find anything. And then the Cadillac comes by again and raises suspicions. It's this whole, you know, 70s cop show type, you know, Cadillac scene. And they eventually find that one of these this packet of books AC guy had tripped over, had been stashed after he went in to check the gauges and weight on the police officers. Green had stashed them next to the surveying building, which is across Gregory Drive from the main library. There's a little hedge there that meets the surveying building. I should say there was a hedge there until about 6 months ago.
Yeah.
They just redid the surveying building, and that hedge is no longer there.
Yeah.
But so they stash the books back there. The police find that those four books there, and they decide to stake out the area and see if this guy comes back.
We got the news headlines coming up here with Michael Kaiser, but some of the people involved: Russell Knowles was a member of the UI Police Department at that time.
Yep.
Crystal Fitzpatrick.
Yeah, yeah.
They're also, so you've talked to these people.
I have talked to them.
Those, they were the primary.
Absolutely, absolutely. Chris Fitzpatrick's still here in town. Russ Knowles lives down in Florida, last time I talked to him. That's right, both university police officers, long time. I talked to several police officers. Dave Cook was a police officer for a long time, talked to him.
Mm-hmm.
It was interesting talking to a lot of folks who were there at the time. Of course, I talked to them 25, 30, now, 35, almost 40 years after the fact, and they don't have clear memories of that night, of course, as you wouldn't. But they remember what it was like to be an officer, or what it was like to be around at the time.
Eventually, Robert Kindred gets arrested. We'll talk about who was prosecuting, what happened, what eventually happened in this case. Some of the names you'll recognize, the people that were involved in this legal matter. We're at 9:34. Sorry, Michael. We got news headlines next. We'll come back with Travis McDade in a moment.
A Penny for Your Thoughts with Brian Barnhart continues on News Talk 1400 WDWS. You can reach out to us on the phone at 217-356-9397, email talk@wdws.com, or text on the Castle Heating and Cooling text line, 217-351-5357.
Back on Penny for Your Thoughts, News Talk 1400 DWS. Corey Swanson is a hands-on owner. He's been a business, Swanson Roofing, the roofing dog, selected as Small Business of the Year by the Champaign County Chamber of Commerce in previous years. The Swanson Roofing Company, truly a family-owned business, 100% owned and operated by Corey Swanson and his wife, Melissa. Corey's a graduate from Rantoul High School in the University of Illinois. Every job site is 100% cleaned up. That's a big thing, getting everything cleaned up. You don't want those nails and pieces of roof laying around. They clean it up 100%. They do not subcontract out any work. The Roofing Dog Crew is comprised of roofing professionals certified in roof installation. They've been with the company for many years. They receive full benefits and 401ks. Bottom line is they're incentivized to do a great job for you. Swanson Roofing will help you with small repairs and help you save your roof. Even if Swanson Roofing did not do the roof, they're happy to come out and fix any problems. Swanson Roofing, the roofing dog, provides service in Champaign, Vermilion, Ford, and McLean counties. We're here with Travis McDade. He has a new book out, a lot of names you'll recognize in the book, in this story of Robert Kindred. It's called Torn from Their Bindings. It involved stealing, acquiring, also purchasing in some cases, rare books, documents, and other printed cultural heritage resources. Travis McDade, where are you from originally?
I was actually born at Carl Hospital.
Where are you?
But I didn't grow up here. My dad was in the military, so we moved around a lot. But my parents are from here. They're Urbana High grads.
Okay.
And me and my five siblings all born in Carl and then moved around a lot. Eventually came back here.
And now you're at the University of Illinois.
That's right.
So Robert Kindred winds up getting arrested. His attorney is someone well-known who just passed away here
recently.
Bob
Aller, that's right. I didn't know that Bob had passed away until you mentioned it, which I'm sorry to hear. There's a few people who I talked to for the course of this book who I'm sorry to say passed away before the book came out. But Bob is, as many of your listeners will know, a local legal legend. Started college at the U of I, went to college here, then went to law school here and worked for the prosecutor's office for a couple years and then sort of hung out his shingle and started to make a name for himself. Had an office right down across from the from Jumer's in Urbana, mm-hmm. right between Jumer's and the Urbana Free Library there, mm-hmm. On that corner. It's no longer there. They bulldozed it a few years ago. It's now just a green space. But but I remember seeing that building for many years, and that's where he was, close to the Champaign County Courthouse.
So on this night in late June 1980, they finally catch Robert Kindred.
They catch him.
He's got a Cadillac full of stolen items.
With Cadillac full. Sort of red-handed. They have to track down the Cadillac separately, but they catch him with his hand on these books. He came back for reasons that I still can't fathom. To try to get these books, maybe because it's, you know, $6,000, $7,000 worth of books. But he comes back, gets caught, and is arraigned. Is arraigned that next morning and hires Bob.
Mm-hmm. At the Champaign County Courthouse in Urbana where he is.
That's right.
At first, and several prosecuting attorneys for the state's attorney's office got involved, but the first one was Tom DeFonis.
That's right. that's right. There's a lot of people who are still around and who are still part of the community who had a hand in this. In fact, Bill Zopp, who's the final mm-hmm. Prosecutor for this, the guy who sees it through to the end, is still practicing, as far as I know, mm-hmm. was still practicing when I interviewed him. But there's a lot of people from the community who in 1980 were active and are still active to this day.
Through the process of arraignment, and there were several delays along the way, but some of the judges involved were Robert Steigman.
Yep.
Also involved was, I'm just blanked out, Harry Clem was
yep,
another
that's
one.
That's right, that's right. Yep. Yeah.
And Judge Jensen was
yes,
the other one.
Yes, that's right.
Of.
I think those are the three. That's mm-hmm. right, that's right.
Yeah, and you talked to any of them at all?
I did not talk to any of them, no.
They handle a zillion cases.
They do handle a zillion cases. I've talked to judges in the past, and they don't remember individual cases at all, especially cases that took place, you know, 30 years ago. And even when they do remember them, they're sort of hesitant to talk about things.
Right. Well, so Bob Aller is the attorney. Now, along the way, there's arraignment. Eventually, he's let out on bond.
Yep.
Kindred goes back to California, where he's not supposed to go, but he does.
Right.
As it turns out, Bob Aller is working on another case at the time.
Yes, the famous Dave Wilson case. That's right. Of course, this is something that people around here remember. And was one of the, you know, writing these books is fun. I wouldn't do it otherwise because I certainly it's not worth it financially. But finding these little stories to write about are terrific. And one of them was the Dave Wilson case. Now I've been a longtime fan of Illinois football, and so any excuse I can get to write about it, I will.
They told you to cut down the story.
But they told I wrote about it too much in here, and they told me to cut most of it out. But in any way, it actually it is relevant. So in 1980, Dave Wilson was this quarterback who had been recruited by Mike White to come, you know, save the Illini. He had been a quarterback at Cal State Fullerton, and on the first play of his first, I think it was Cal State Fullerton, but on the first play of his first. First year there, he broke his wrist.
Got hurt.
Yeah. Before the season or before the school year even started, the first play. And so the whatever community college governing body was out there said, yeah, that doesn't count as a season, right? You have two more seasons. So he played two more seasons, and then he came to Illinois expecting to be a junior. And the Big Ten said, nope, you're a senior. And then they said something to the effect of, not only are you only going to get 1 year of eligibility, but because you're a senior, you only have enough credits to be a junior, so you can't play this year until you have enough credits to be a senior.
Right. And that's where Bob Alder came in and was involved in that. Eventually, Dave Olson played that whole year.
He played that whole year because Bob was in court almost every day, right, against the NCAA, against the Big Ten. He was in state court. He was in federal. He was everywhere just trying to keep Dave Wilson on the field, which he did.
So eventually, they get back to Robert Kindred.
Yeah.
And he gets a fairly light sentence, right?
He sort of have to understand, and I go through this the first part of the book, the level of this crime. And it's an immense crime. It's a nationwide crime. And there's thousands and thousands and thousands of these stolen items in the back of this Cadillac. And these are the ones that they still have. They've sold many of them along the way. And it's this enormous crime. And he basically gets a slap on the wrist. He gets probation.
And a fine.
And a small fine, which he doesn't pay. Yeah.
So eventually, the U of I police did some really, I mean, they were really detailed with their work.
Yep.
They went through a lot of this. I know they were disappointed a little bit at the time, thinking we did all this work and he wound up with not much of a sentence, or at least, you know, in their mind.
That's one of the great things about this book is that I have to go where the sources tell me to go. But in this book, the sources told me that the U of I police acted professionally. And in a way that you wouldn't expect researching these crimes over the years, I found that sometimes law enforcement doesn't take book crime seriously. The U of I police took it very seriously. They did not only on the night when they staked out these four stolen books, but after that, the subsequent investigation, they just did a bang up job. Mm-hmm. And then the librarians at the U of I who had to sort of piece together or reverse engineer how this crime took place also did a bang up job. All of these U of I employees deserve a big pat on the back. Anyway, they did all this work that they thought was basically fruitless because it ended up amounting to just this probation.
All right. But all of that work leads eventually to some charges, and we'll talk about that after the break. Travis McDade is our guest from over at the University of Illinois. Jim Dye will join us in hour number two. We'll take your open line phone calls about the topics of the day, both local and national. We'll do all that in the second hour. But back to kind of wrap up this particular segment with our author about what happened to Robert Kindred eventually, and we'll do that after this. 951, Penny for your thoughts at 66 degrees, 356-9397. You can text us, Castle Heating and Cooling text line 351-5357, or email us, talk at WDWS.com. Travis McDade is our guest. He's an author. He works over at the University of Illinois. Authors on the side here, and he's got Torn from Their Bindings, which is a new book coming out here in the next week. You can look for that. Probably get that on, what, look around Amazon?
Just on Amazon probably, yeah.
First, will it be in any local stores that you know of? Or?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe. Yeah. Maybe like, Barnes & Noble will carry it. I'm not sure. Okay. They did carry my last one, so they might, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Robert Kindred, we're talking about, went on this stealing spree, if you will, from public libraries, university libraries all around the country, Texas A&M out west, down south at Texas A&M, Rice, USC, UCLA, Oklahoma State, maybe.
Yeah, Kansas State, Oklahoma State. Yeah, just basically any any major library that they could stop at. Yeah.
Some of the people involved early in prosecuting at the beginning, Tom DeFontis, of course, has been a judge for many years now. Robert Steigman, also Bob Alder was his attorney. Ray Matlock was an in-law, owned Washawile.
That's right.
Married one of Robert's sisters in the area where the Krannert Center is now.
Yep.
And then eventually wound up with a fairly light sentence, but the work that the U of I police did eventually the feds, the FBI, got back involved.
They sort of took over, yeah.
And he wound up in front of another judge, well-known around here, Harold Baker in Vermilion County, but he faced federal charges.
He did face federal charges. It's one of the interesting things about this. So the crime side of all of these things I write about, I find interesting, but it's the legal side that is the bread and butter to me. It's the things that I find to be worth writing about. And in this case, what you had was a guy who was prosecuted at the state level and then several years later prosecuted essentially for the same crime at the federal level. It's not double jeopardy because it's not the same crime.
It was interstate commerce.
It was interstate transportation of stolen items. But it's arising from the same crime and the same arrest, of course. But yeah, he's hauled to Danville, which he's living in California at the time after having done basically nothing towards this probation. And he's hauled to Danville, which is where the criminal courthouse was back then, and forced to, sort of face up to these charges again.
And Harold Baker was the federal judge.
Yep.
That basically did all the sentencing, right? Arguments were made in front of him. And
yep. Yeah, it was really terrific reading reading his sentence, reading what he says, because of course they go through this whole process of Kindred pleading guilty, and he had done the same thing at the state, and the judge had given him this cupcake sentence, and at the federal level they give him a serious sentence, right? I mean he doesn't buy any of this nonsense, and he actually sentences him to prison time.
Got a text in, Castle Heating and Cooling text line. It's, what is the name of the steam operator that night?
Willis Smalling.
Willis Smalling.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Well, good memory there.
Yeah, I spoke to him probably 10 years ago now.
Yeah.
So he still lives in town.
Hmm. So he wound up with a served five years and
he got a five-year sentence. He didn't serve that long. Okay. He served a little over 2 years.
All right.
Yeah.
And where's he living now? Do you know?
He's out in California. Southern California.
What's he doing?
Still in the antique print business.
Yeah.
That's actually how I tracked him down. You know, I spent a lot of time trying to find him.
Because you hesitated to call him, right?
I did hesitate to call him. You know, one of the things about calling these guys is they're not going to want to talk to me. They, you know, I'm not on their side of things, and so they're not going to want to talk to me. I've had that happen before. Mm-hmm. But I at least have to say I tried to call him, and boy was I surprised when he just kept talking. Nice guy, knowledgeable, just verbose, and we talked for a long time. Now we didn't really talk about the crime in particular,
but his background,
yeah, what he's doing now, and all these. Mm-hmm. He had a lot of good memories, and talked to him a while.
Well, it was an interesting read for me, and I don't know a whole lot about, I mean, this is your field of expertise, but I just found it interesting all the different places on campus that are mentioned in the book, all the people that were involved in the case, all the hard work that was done by the U of I Police Department.
Yeah, one of the things about the places on campus, one of the things I like to say is that the good side of working at a state university that doesn't do a lot of, renovations and updates and repairs is that everything basically looks exactly the way it looked in 1980, including, the window he broke into and the bathroom he climbed into and the surveying building and all these places.
As far as the academic buildings per se, because the Green Street's are totally different. I mean, with all
Green
the
is totally different. That's right. That's actually one of the things that has changed.
And the university library is unique in that it's underground.
The main library, the stacks, of course, are above ground there, but that all looks basically the same as it did, and so I could go to these places as I did, hundreds of times, and sort of describe them and get a sense of what it was like, and just visit be in the location to see what it would have been like at that time.
Yeah, well, it's a fascinating read, and it's your fourth book. So the other books you've written are similar type topics, but not quite all the local.
That's right. Yeah. This is the only one that has this specific Illinois bent to it. The first two took place in Manhattan, which couldn't be farther away from where I am, both physically and mentally.
Yeah.
But that's right. This is just this one that happened to have a really important Illinois component.
Name of the book is Torn from Their Bindings, The Story of Art, Science, and the Pillaging of American University Libraries by Travis McDade. How long you plan to keep doing this for the foreseeable future?
Yeah, that's as long as they keep letting me do it, I will continue to do it. Yeah,
I know you really enjoy it.
I do. It's fun, the discovery process. You know, writing is an arduous task. But I don't know how to describe it. It's once you get something right and once you discover something, there's this elation to it that is not like anything else. And so I will continue to do it.
Yeah. Well, it's been a pleasure getting to know you, visiting with you.
It's been nice to be here. I appreciate being on the show that I've listened to for many years now, and I appreciate you having me.
Yeah. Well, good to have you on, and good luck with the book.
Thanks, Brian.
All of that, and we'll look forward to having people get a hold of it.
Sounds great.
All
thanks.
Right. Very good. Torn from Their Bindings, Travis McDade, a big story involving a lot of names you recognize from the legal world, but also just locations around town in Urbana. It was a story at the time back in 1980, as it turned out, a lot of people may have forgotten about, and I think brought it back to life here today. So we appreciate Travis being with us here from the University of Illinois. If you've got some basement issues since 1986, the Woods Basement folks, Woods family, has helped over 55,000 homeowners protect your home's investment. Get your free estimate from Woods and fix those basement and crawl space cracks once and for all. And they've won several awards, but they're most proud of their Better Business Bureau Torch Awards that they've won. Remember, Woods estimates on anything involving your foundation, basement cracks, any of that, don't cost you anything, but how much is it costing you to not fix that problem? Call 888-935-4333 or go online to woodsbasementsystems.com. 888-935-4333, woodsbasementsystems.com. Jim Dye joins me in hour number two. We'll open up the phone lines, have you join us in the next hour on WDWS Champaign-Urbana.
It's the second hour of A Penny for Your Thoughts with Brian Barnhart on News Talk 1400 WDWS. You can reach out to us on the phone at 217-356-9397, email talk at WDWS.com, or Castle Heating and Cooling text line 217-351-5357. Now, here's Brian Barnhart.
Welcome back. Penny for Your Thoughts, News Talk 1400 DWS. We appreciate Travis McDade being with us in that first hour. Jim Dye is going to join us here for hour number two. Want to remind you, this is the final week to show your support for your favorite businesses, the News Talk 1400 WDWS People's Choice Competition. Take a couple of minutes, vote at WDWS.com. Vote in one category or all 150 if you like. The People's Choice from News Gazette Media and Wallace Land and Auction. We're back on Penny for Your Thoughts. 356-9397 is the phone number. You can text us, Castle Heating and Cooling text line 3515-357, or email us talk at WDWS.com. And Jim Dye joins us. You remember this, the sentencing part of that case, right?
I do.
We were just talking about
vaguely. I was in the old federal court in Danville, and Judge Baker was the sentencing judge, and I don't recall a lot of details about it, but it seemed like the gentleman, whose name I didn't even remember till you just mentioned it, Mr. Kindred, was involved in a lot of this sort of thing across the country. And he was very much not interested in taking any responsibility for his conduct. And I don't think Judge Baker was real impressed with that.
Yeah.
But he ended up getting some prison time, which I understand you say he did not serve all of his sentence.
Not the all of the sentence.
He probably was a mild prisoner and got some time off for good behavior. But, that's one of the cases where you have really sophisticated, smart criminals who are able to take advantage of, what really is very lax security in some of these university libraries, where they have material that is extremely valuable, but they want to have open and available to the public. So it was pretty sophisticated criminal enterprise. They just kind of pushed their luck,
yeah.
I guess.
It was interesting because I talked to Carol real quick, Carol Varell, earlier this morning, because she knew Judge Baker.
Yeah.
And he, I guess the federal court, at least the criminal part, was over in Danville.
It was,
before they moved it here, right?
Right.
To Urbana.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's interesting.
I think the Vermilion County now operates that federal building, which actually is quite a nice federal building, and it's a great thing for Vermilion County to have. I think they bought it from the federal government. That's where the federal courthouse was at the time. Mm-hmm. Of course, there was a lot of controversy about it moving because the people in Danville considered the federal court to be a part of their local economic engine, and they didn't want to lose that to Champaign.
All right. Well, Jim Dye is with us here this whole hour. If you'd like to call in, feel free to do that. Any topic you want to bring up. Of course, there's a lot of stuff to talk about. We'll get into some of that here. 356-9397. You can text us, Castle Heating and Cooling text line 3515357 or email us at talk@wdws.com. Well, President Trump making some news. We had the big embassy move.
Yes.
On Monday.
Yes.
That was, what do you make of all of that? And just,
well, you know, the loss of life is regrettable. I feel sorry for the Palestinians. I think they're being exploited by their leaders. And, of course, you see the loss of life was tremendous. And I just figure that's kind of par for the course for the Middle East. I mean, how long has this been going on?
Well, and a lot of people, you know, we looked at it, talked about it some yesterday, was that the Congress passed what the Jerusalem Act or whatever it was, and basically declared that Jerusalem was going to be the capital, or they wanted to move the embassy.
Well, you know, the thing about this is that presidential candidates and presidents and members of Congress have been paying lip service to the idea of moving this embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem for years, and they always came up with an excuse saying, well, we won't do it right now, but we should do it someday, and Jerusalem is really the capital. Well, you know, as his practice, Donald Trump doesn't pay lip service to to issues. When he says he's going to do something, he does it, and come hell or high water. So,
yeah, because most of the governmental business was being done in Jerusalem anyway. I mean, the Knesset, isn't it there? And
yeah, I mean, it is the seat of the seat of government for the country of Israel. I mean, it just is, and it's like saying, it is as if the Israeli diplomats and other diplomats from Europe said, well, you know, Washington, D.C. is really the capital, but we're going to put our embassy in Philadelphia. I mean, you know, it just doesn't work, and it's kind of reality. But, you know, a lot of the Middle East is about symbolism, and, of course, then this official move is what I guess the Palestinians and Hamas and all that would consider one more impediment to them getting what their goal is, which is, I think, unachievable anyhow.
Visiting with Jim Dye this morning, 356-9397. The lines are open. It's your forum. If you want to bring something up to Jim, feel free to do that, to him or me. We're both here, so you can visit with us during this hour. I think there'll be a North Korean summit. North Koreans making noise today, like, you know, they're mad at the
U.S.
and South Korea were doing joint
exercises.
North
Koreans are very interesting negotiating opponents. They rattle a lot of sabers, and they come up with the most ingenious invective to hurl at the opposition. And I suspect there's going to be a summit. They seem like they've gone a long way not to have one, and they're just kind of, you know, throwing down some chits to maybe set the stage for the fact that they're not going to be a pushover. You know, I don't. I think there'll be a summit. On the other hand, I thought Hillary Clinton was going to win the election. So, you know,
what do I know?
You
never know, do you?
You never know.
All right. Yeah, they were mad. North Korea was mad. The U.S. and South Korea were doing some joint military exercises, which go on frequently in that part of the world. And that's what they were upset about today.
You know, so from our perspective, I mean, the U.S., I think, never thinks a thing about why would we want to invade North Korea? I mean, don't we have enough problems?
Yeah, I know.
But from their perspective, that's something they use on a daily basis to keep their public on a heightened alert about the evil people outside their country. And that's one of the ways that, you know, they play on that nationalistic fervor to kind of hide the ball in terms of how miserable life is in North Korea.
I'd be interested to find out how many times that Kim family, whether it's Kim Jong-un or his dad or his grandfather,
yeah,
even left the country other than going to China, because they're going to meet in Singapore, but I don't think he's been outside that area ever.
Well, you know, they don't call it the Hermit Kingdom for nothing. They are very much self-involved and, of course, extremely hostile to the South Korean government on their border. But, yeah, they play it close to the vest. And, of course, they're a starving, impoverished, truly one of the worst authoritarian country in the world, with a cult of personality that, you know, we can't, for their leadership, that Americans just simply cannot conceive.
Cannot fathom.
So it's, trying to understand them is extremely difficult because everything about them is irrational from our point of view.
All right, we've got Anna Wall on the line here. Anna Wall, how are you?
Well, you've got my favorite reporter on the, there.
And here's my favorite caller.
Thank you.
She's my only fan. My only fan, and I'm grateful.
Well, I really don't want to be a nuisance, but I want to thank you for expanding my intellectual horizons regarding gerrymandering. Now, I had political science at the U of I, but they never went into anything like that. And I learned a lot from having read that article. And if you have a little time this morning, I imagine the people in the listening audience who could benefit from what you had to say.
Well, you know, the reason you probably didn't hear a lot about gerrymandering is because it was for so long accepted as a political fact of life. I mean, it's been with us since the beginning of the Republic, and by what I mean by gerrymandering is it's the manipulation of legislative district lines to determine
right.
election results in advance. And of course,
right.
as you know, time passes and people's attitudes change, and the idea that to the victor go the spoils. Has kind of been usurped in some quarters by saying, well, why should political parties get the spoils? I mean, aren't they supposed to serve the public? And one of the things that serves the public most is fair elections and fair and competitive elections and voter choice. So that's why you're seeing the national movement on gerrymandering, which is very successful in some states, most recently Ohio, where they had a referendum vote on it. I think it passed 75%. We're going to do away with this political partisan process, and we're going to make it non-political, and we're going to create more competitive districts with expanded voter choice. And they put enough pressure on the legislature in Ohio that, and this was one party government in Ohio, the Republicans control the legislature and the governor's office, and the Republicans agreed to put the thing on the ballot, and they're going to change the way they do things. Now, of course, Illinois is the dinosaur when it comes to doing away with the old system, and it serves the powers that be very well. And so once again, the legislative leaders in Springfield ignored a request to put the issue on the ballot, just as 2 years ago they managed to get the Supreme Court to strike down a citizen petition process. So in Illinois, it's back to the future. Is that what was
yeah.
it? We're going to keep continue to do things Mike Madigan's way.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Anna Wall.
Okay.
Appreciate
but
it.
This issue is not going to go away. You're going to yeah. see, I think in the next couple of weeks, you're going to see a decision involving a number of states, including Maryland, Wisconsin, Texas, involving the gerrymandering issue, which the court may strike down as unconstitutional and may decide that this is simply too complicated for the court to handle and leave it to the states, which the states are doing good work on their own, not all of them, unfortunately. I'm not sure it's really a justiciable issue because the solution is so difficult for a court to mandate.
I think Pennsylvania just had a, then they had an issue with all of that.
They did, you know, and that was a case where the Democratic-controlled state Supreme Court said that the Republican-drawn map was unconstitutional. So even there, we have a little bit of partisan tinge to the process.
We're here with Jim Dye, 1023 on Penny for Your Thoughts. We're just talking big topics of the day. We'll get into those along the way. If you have one you want to bring up, got a strange story about a Champaign police officer. We'll get into that. That's a big local story.
That is an odd one, isn't it?
Yeah, we'll do that next. As we continue with Jim Dye, give us your phone calls, emails, and texts. Back in a moment. We're back with Jim Dye this morning. Penny for Your Thoughts, News Talk 1400 DWS, as we have open forum here in this hour, open line. A Champaign police officer due back in court in July on charges he took items from several vehicles in his home community of Fisher. 43-year-old Justice Clinton made his first court appearance yesterday afternoon. 3 counts of burglary to motor vehicles. His bond was set at $10,000, and the Champaign County Sheriff's Office says Clinton's linked to thefts from at least 10 cars from 1 a.m. to 6:30 a.m. on Sunday. That's pretty strange.
It is very odd when police officers step across the bounds and commit crimes or allegedly commit crimes, but it does happen from time to time. And, you know, I think it's unfortunate because I'm sure that, you know, this really doesn't make the police look very good, and it's unfair, but that's a fact of life. You know, they're going to be tarred by their association with this guy. And I guess it's just important to remember that most police officers do the best they can and are honest, but they're like everybody else. You know, there are bad apples. I mean, I remember a few years ago when we actually had a Champaign police, been more than a few years ago now, a Champaign police officer who was cultivating and selling marijuana, and he ended up being prosecuted, I think, in Iroquois County, where he got probation. And at the time, the News Gazette actually wrote an editorial saying this is simply not acceptable and the federal government must step in and prosecute this case. And they actually did. Hmm. And they filed their own charges because of the dual jurisdiction between the federal and state courts. And he was charged again and sentenced to prison.
356-9397 is the phone number. Text line, Castle Heating and Cooling sponsors that. 351-5357. You can email us, talk at WDWS.com. Champaign Police spokesperson says Clinton has been with the department for 14 years. And she says on May 8th, he entered into a separation and release agreement instead of being fired. And also, they say he was placed on administrative leave on Sunday for violations unrelated to his arrest. So that's.
Sounds like there are many layers to the story.
Yeah, that's for sure. All right, we got Michael Kaiser coming up with the news. I will tell you quickly, if you're within 10 years of retirement, thinking and planning for your golden years can seem daunting, even overwhelming. For help getting started and focusing on retirement, Busey Investment Services and Busey Wealth Management share some tips. They say to reassess your living expenses, consider all income sources, manage your taxes, but it'd be better to tap taxable or tax-deferred accounts first. You can account for health care as you age. Of course, your medical costs go up. Pay off debt and power up your savings. You'll have more flexibility. And save as much as you can now and let compound interest work in your favor. As you prepare for retirement, those are just a few of the factors to consider. Make the process easier by breaking it into smaller categories and use the years to plan ahead accordingly. The professionals at Busey Investment Services and Busey Wealth Management will take the time to understand you and create a sound investment plan for your goals. Their number to call is 1-800-67-BUSEY. Or visit Busey.com today. Michael Kaiser next with news headlines, your phone calls, emails, and text straight ahead with Jim Dye from the News Gazette. Back with more after the news.
A Penny for Your Thoughts with Brian Barnhart continues on News Talk 1400 WDWS.
Penny for Your Thoughts continues here on this Wednesday. We talked to Travis McDade in the first hour, the author of a new book that is out, Torn from Their Bindings, involving the University of Illinois police and a case that dates all the way back to 1980. Jim Dye is with us here in this hour. We're just talking about the various topics of the day. Whatever's on your mind, feel free to bring one up if you have a topic you'd like to address. Otherwise, we're just talking about some of the big current issues, both nationally and locally. We're all kind of waiting to see the Burnham Mansion move at some point, huh?
Boy, that's going to be a project, isn't it? I'm going to have to see it to believe it. And I guess people can do magnificent things, but boy, that's a handful, isn't it?
Yeah, they've got a deadline to get it out of there, or they start getting charged.
They do.
So much a day.
You know, there's been some quotes from Tom Bruno about the process of the house that he moved, and he lost mm-hmm. money on it and the whole bit. I remember when Tom was doing that, and I know he was more than happy to be done with it when it was finally over. And I think he probably thought he bit off more than he could chew.
Well, that's a big building to try to move. I mean, just with all the, you got to get the, I think he said they lower the power lines. You've got trees and street, you know, where are you going to take it, first of all?
Yeah, the house that Tom moved was a relatively small house. This thing is huge. I mean, they call it a mansion for a reason. And you're going to put that on the back of some truck and drive it down the street? I mean, I'll be fascinated to see how they do it.
Absolutely. 356-9397 is the phone number. You can text us on the Castle Heating and Cooling text line, 351-5357, or email us, talk at WDWS.com. We'll have an open line tomorrow for the most part up until 10:30. Busey Money Talk at 10:30. We're going to talk about the royal wedding on Friday. An expert royal watcher works over at the Geese College of Business at the University of Illinois, but she knows all this stuff. I was talking to her on the phone, and I'm like, okay, I found the person I'm looking for because you got the big wedding on Saturday.
Well, that would not be me because I must say I haven't paid a lot of attention to it. Well, I think it's a woman thing.
Yeah, I think it is, but it's either way, it's interesting for a lot of people. So let's go to Brian. Hey, Brian, good morning.
Hello, Jim and Brian.
Hello.
I have an observation on what to do with the Lincoln Square facility.
Okay.
What do you think about making it a retirement community, building some places for the baby boomers who are going to need more and more semi-assisted care, and you know, the post office is there, and you've got the Busey Bank real close, and the bus system's right there, and you could cater the whole place to the geriatric crowd.
Well, you know, I don't know. That doesn't sound too appetizing to me, but maybe that's because I might be in them soon enough. But, you know, I guess that's as good as anything. I mean, I think Tom Kasich had a pretty good column a couple of weeks ago when he interviewed the owner of the Lincoln Square, and he said, gee, nobody's asked him what he thinks about it, and I didn't get the impression that he thinks too many changes are needed. So, you know, we're all talking about what should be done with it, and the guy who's not part of the discussion is the guy who actually owns it, so...
He should have a say, I would think.
Yeah. Well, we could also just pick it up and put it on a truck and move it someplace.
Put it with the Burnham Mansion,
The baby boomers, we're all growing older, and we're going to need places like that. And I think if you cater the whole mall towards people like that, you know, they can get in there and walk and stuff. It costs some money, of course, and you could even... you could even have some people rent out rooms in the Urbana Lincoln, you know, go down and eat at the basement. And I think you can have a little city there of some sort.
Okay.
Well, we'll see what happens. I don't know. I know Urbana's, you know, Champaign's downtown obviously has been booming, and Urbana's added some little things along the way.
Urbana has made some progress, yeah.
Yeah, but the, you know, the Lincoln Square piece, I guess, is what they looked at. You know, could that be a centerpiece of something bigger beyond what they have now? And as you say, the owner is the guy that he needs to decide.
Well, you know, one of the ideas is to, I guess, restore through traffic to the area that Lincoln Square covered and cut off the traffic flow. And of course that would require some major surgery, and it also would require the permission of the guy who owns it.
Oh, wow.
So I don't know what's going to happen with it. I mean, you know, how long have we been talking about Lincoln Square? For as long as I've been around here.
Could I comment on Mr. Mueller?
Sure, go right ahead.
I think the Mueller team is the team that really needs to be investigated. I mean, you talk about an impartial juror. I mean, he's got his a bunch of Democrats and cohorts all around him. I mean, hardly anybody that you can consider a conservative or a Republican.
Well, you know what? That's not going to happen. I mean, Mr. Mueller, he is like an unguided missile, and he's going to do his thing. And I wouldn't be surprised if a year from now he's still not investigating.
Well, why couldn't the Congress put an investigation on the investigator?
Well, I guess they could, but that's pretty rare. I mean, maybe that'll come to that. I mean, this is turning into a really ugly partisan battle, but, you know, he has the legal authority to do what he's doing. He's working under the purported supervision of the Assistant Attorney General, and he has a mandate, which he may or may not be exceeding, or maybe he doesn't even have a mandate. I don't know. That seems to be an issue. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you're right. Your point is correct in that there are a lot of people that are really unhappy with how he's going about his business, and, of course, the fact that he has staffed his prosecution team with almost entirely or entirely with, you know, partisan Democratic prosecutors, that doesn't help his image. I think he had a real blind spot there because it does create kind of an appearance of partisanship, but we're just going to have to see where it goes.
All right, Brian?
Yeah. He's got carte blanche, it seems to me.
It does look like right that, now. Doesn't it? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just hoping he doesn't investigate me. That's all I'm concerned about.
Oh, we're doomed, man. I tore a label off a mattress when I was
there. Well, there you go. You better be thinking about that.
All right.
Don't be saying that on the air.
Okay.
Thanks, Brian.
Bye.
We're back with Jim Dye after this. Time out. Penny for Your Thoughts continues after this. Brian Barnhart with Jim Dye. We're on Penny for Your Thoughts on the anniversary 150 years ago today. The U.S. Senate failed by one vote to convict President Andrew Johnson in his impeachment trial.
You know, that's interesting because in the historical perspective now is that that's an impeachment trial that was totally partisan that never should have taken place. I mean, he was accused of violating. He fired a member of the cabinet.
Yep, Secretary of War.
Yeah. Yep. And and they had passed a law that basically said a president cannot fire a member of the executive branch. Clearly unconstitutional. he did it anyway, and so they said, okay, we're going to impeach you. And, of course, that was all about Reconstruction and the radical Republicans against Johnson, who was, shall we say, not moving very fast.
Not as radical
on,
as...
On Reconstruction. Mm-hmm. And but that does raise some interesting questions for today, which is, you know, Mueller basically is running an impeachment investigation of Trump that stems from his firing of James Comey, something he clearly had the authority to do. Mm. Well, okay, so the issues don't really change very much, do they? 150 years later, we're talking about the same thing.
One vote, you can read about it in JFK's book, Profiles
in Courage, actually written by Theodore Sorensen.
Mm-hmm. And John Kennedy's name's on it.
And John Kennedy got the Pulitzer Prize for it, even though it wasn't even nominated. It's the only book in the history of the Pulitzer Prizes that won a Pulitzer Prize without being one of the books nominated for the Pulitzer Prize. That was courtesy of his dad's influence. Theodore Sorensen, who always credited as being the author of the book, you know, he was also the guy who wrote the phrase, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. So when people would approach him and say, are you really the author of Profiles in Human Courage, he would say, ask not. So he had a sense of humor about it.
Let's go to Ken. Ken, good morning.
Yes, I'd like to talk to about a problem I have with billing at Carl Clinic here in town.
Oh, boy, I'm sure we cannot help you with that, but go ahead.
I hope that maybe there's a politician working that or listening that could do something about it. I've been a member of Health Alliance before it became Health Alliance, Carl Care, for 17 years, and now I'm back on it. And they have shown a consistent pattern of denying legitimate claims. And when I've called to ask them about that, they have even lied to me and said that the claims were paid when they were not. And I spoke with a insurance agent here in Champaign County. I'm not going to name him, but he probably sells more Medicare or Medigap policies than anybody else in Champaign County. He's very successful, and that's all he does. And he said that Carl Clinic and Christie Clinic do this on a consistent basis, and particularly toward elderly people. And he said, they tell people all the time, if you get a bill, you bring it to us before you pay it, because there's a good chance it's not a legitimate bill. And he said, sometimes people listen, but he said, sometimes people don't. And he said, these people have never owed a dime in their lives that they didn't pay. And they pay the bill. And he said, sometimes it takes a year or more to get that money back for them. Why is it that our legislature puts up with that?
I suspect the legislature probably doesn't have a lot to do with what it is you're upset about, and I'm not sure who can fix this. There's got to be some sort of ombudsman over in the Carl system who could sit down with you and go over your bills. So you're saying they don't pay claims, and so you have to pay money out of your own pocket for things that should be covered?
Oh,
is that what you're
saying? I won't do it. I will not pay a claim. I have 100% coverage. I will not pay another dime.
Okay, so does it get paid then? Who pays it? Does the insurance company then pay it?
It takes months for them to pay it.
Well, you know, I don't know. Sometimes you get caught in these computer systems that I don't know what to tell you, really.
You know, if it's a mistake, why don't they ever mail me a check? It's always in their favor. I was recently in the hospital in Chicago, and Medicare paid all but $1,400 of a two-week stay. I mean, $1,400 is not a bad bill, and they should have been celebrating, and they denied that claim. And it's always, well, you did this wrong, or you did that wrong, or they did this wrong, or they did that wrong. It's intentional. I am absolutely convinced of this.
Well, maybe somebody's listening out there that can help out with it. Okay?
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Ken. Back to the phones with Jim Dye here. Dave, good morning.
Hey, good morning. I called about something else, but real quick I wanted to touch on something Jim said. Did you say that the Mueller investigation stemmed from Comey being fired? because I thought the Mueller stuff started before.
No, Mueller was not appointed until after Comey was fired, and then Comey was the one who leaked the contents of some kind of memo that he filed, and then Rosenstein ended up appointing Mueller. That's how it happened. Mueller succeeded Comey, although Comey was the director of the FBI, and Mueller is the special counsel. Right. So there's a difference there, but no, Mueller followed Comey's dismissal.
Okay, I thought that it was initiated before that because they were trying to find Russian collusion.
Well, no, there was an investigation which Comey, as the head of the FBI, was leading.
Right.
And after he was fired, then there was such a political ruckus about it, then Rosenstein appointed Mueller as the special counsel.
And Sessions had already recused himself from anything related to Russia.
So you're right. There was an investigation pending, but Mueller, but not being led by Mueller, Mueller followed Comey's dismissal.
Isn't it? I mean, it's just such a mess. It's hard to even keep track of it. Need a chart.
No, you're right. I don't know
it
what
becomes alphabet soup after a while. I mean, right?
right. So my comment I wanted to make was, I don't know if you happened to see the county board committee of the whole meeting last night, but at the end, Pius Weibel had brought up the GIS system and how you can search for parcels that you may think are part of your property, but are not. This is the whole big thing of, you know, the Nasty Joe scandal, and how there may be, you know, it's really interesting because I had no idea about this, that this could even happen. But obviously, when a piece of land is subdivided, there are sometimes easements that are put into different areas that then those are like basically left unclaimed, but you may think it's part of your property.
Right.
And that woman in Urbana had that issue. But anyways, it was really an interesting presentation, and people should really look into it because there could be these potential situations where you think it's your property, but there's this little sliver of land.
Right.
That was just never claimed, essentially.
Well, you know, that was the basis of the the driveway dispute in Urbana that I wrote about for months before the case finally concluded. But the people who find themselves, of course, you want to avoid that situation if you can. But there is a legal ruling that fits that. It's called the law of adverse possession, that if you think that property is yours for a certain period of time and you use that property as if it was yours, even though it's really unclaimed, the law will recognize your possession by right of adverse possession.
Yeah.
So, but you don't want to get in the middle of that, because that's a legal issue that have to be determined by the courts, and that involves lawyers and that involves legal bills.
Yeah. Hey, Dave, I got to move, but thank you.
Thanks.
Appreciate it. Back in a moment with Jim Dye. All right, about to wrap it up here. Quick text. We got about 10 seconds. Where do they plan to move the mansion to, the Burnham Mansion? Do we know that? I think they're still they're working on that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A date to be chosen later, kind of like a player to be traded later.
All right. Hey, Jim, thank you.
My pleasure.
As always, we'll do it again on WDWS Champaign-Urbana. Have a great day, everybody. It's 11 o'clock.